Okay, welcome to the deep dive. You shared a truly fascinating narrative source with us, a story that plunges into a world of ancient gods, powerful city-states, hidden magic, and yeah, really dangerous journeys.
It's definitely a complex text. It kind of weaves together mythology and these really personal struggles, dropping us right into a landscape where, you know, divine conflicts just spill over into the human realm, affects everyone caught in between.
Absolutely. And our mission in this deep dive, looking at the material you've provided, is to go beyond just, you know, summarizing the events. We really want to pull out the core insights, the surprising connections, the why behind the what in this story, especially as we follow this character named Mad.
Think of it as a shortcut, maybe, to understanding the deeper currents running through the narrative, the big questions it asks about belief, resistance, the nature of power, and what freedom even means. We're doing this deep dive just for you, digging into the source material you've given us.
So let's jump right in. We first find Mad in this place called Abzu. Now, on the surface, the source describes Abzu almost like a paradise, doesn't it? Food everywhere, fruit just waiting.
It certainly sounds idyllic, and the text really contrasts it sharply with the world Mad knew. You know, Earth or Dilmun, Abzu has no silver-hungry soldiers, no scheming nodal women, no punishing priests like that Kotar character, no need for walls, not even animal sacrifice. It's presented as free from so many of those problems.
Which makes the insight here so striking. Despite all that, Mad feels completely isolated. The source says he's longing for Earth, yearning for the world, the memories he left, even though, you know, people back home would probably risk everything just to be there.
It's a really powerful picture, isn't it? This idea that just having stuff or being safe isn't the same as belonging or feeling truly home. His internal state is just totally disconnected from everything around him.
And he wants out. Desperately.
Oh, he does. He tries to find the end of the garden, but he can't. And crucially, he can't stray too far from Anki's palace. The source says the exit is through there. It notes this. This feeling of unease, this distress when he moves away, like he's still tethered somehow.
There's also that really intense moment where he tries to end his life in the lake.
Yes, swimming until he's exhausted, trying to drown, only to find out that death just isn't possible in Abzu. But what's really revealing there is his feeling of freedom underwater. The source suggests Enki's power, which seems tied to the land, doesn't quite reach there. It highlights this kind of split, maybe, between the land and the water worlds, one possibly offering a different sort of liberty.
And being alone with his thoughts in Abzu seems to give Mad some clarity about things that happened before.
It allows him to piece together clues from his experiences, yeah. And it leads to a pretty big revelation about Ram.
Ram, the one everyone thought was dead.
Exactly. The source shows Mad slowly realizing that Ram didn't actually die and, get this, can inhabit mortal bodies. He connects the dots. Ram came back with Ninjuber, probably disguised as that old warrior Mad saw, remember? The one who tried to stop him going into the tunnel, who watched the competition hidden, and who looked at Mad with such sorrow when he was taken to the temple vault.
So that old warrior wasn't just some random guy. That was Ram.
That's the connection Mad makes, yeah, mulling things over in Abzu.
But even in this isolation, there are these moments of connection, and things get genuinely supernatural.
The source mentions he finds solace remembering Inanna. Just the memory of her sitting by the lake under a fir tree apparently makes his captivity bearable.
And his music, that's still his outlet.
He plays the Buyuludil, that magic flute, for Inanna, composing new melodies all about separation and longing. Even if no one else hears them, it's his way of, you know, processing it all.
And this is when Ram reappears, confirming Mad's suspicions.
Yes, and here the narrative takes a really surprising turn. Ram drops this bombshell.
Yeah.
I am a goddess, and says she needs to enter Mad's body to get through some secret passage. The old warrior body is apparently already dead, and Mad's body is described as a gift for Enki in this whole exchange.
Wow. A goddess needing a mortal body to move around. That says a lot about how divinity works in this world.
It definitely raises questions about the limits, maybe even the vulnerabilities of the gods themselves. The text specifically notes Mad's reaction. Hishulishik, omadu busuzler, madi tedergen et mishti. These words he was completely unaccustomed to made him really deeply uneasy. It just shakes up his whole understanding of the divine.
So Mad, now potentially sharing his body with a goddess, is thrown back into the world he knows, city-states, conflict.
Right back into the thick of it. He gets introduced to Prugat's companions, Gami, Mashnu, and Hadan, The source even catches Pugat making this ironic joke about them being Enki's most trusted men.
Right, given they're obviously working against Enki now.
Yeah.
And Mashtu proves useful immediately.
He does. Crucial help reopening that tunnel connected to the Eridu Temple, a direct route back into all the complexity. And Pugat also fills Mad in on what Inanna's been up to since she got back from Abzu.
She managed to get Enki drunk, right, and steal those vital Miz's, the divine powers or laws.
Using her skyboat, no less. The source details how Isamit and sea monsters chased her, but she made it back to Uruk, stopping at 7 places along the way. Quite the journey.
And people celebrated her return.
Oh yeah, big celebrations. But the source adds this telling detail about her husband, Tammuz. He didn't greet her, didn't even attend the festivities. It hints at some serious tension there, even among the gods she's returned to.
From Uruk, their journey takes them towards Arj. And it sounds pretty rough.
They have to take this dangerous route through deserts and forests, specifically to dodge Enki's men and robbers. The source really emphasizes the danger needing bows and swords for hyenas, jackals, sleepless nights.
And the atmosphere sounds thick with this sort of supernatural dread.
Yep.
Yeah, the sound of owls is mentioned as particularly ominous, signifying Ormond Buyveri, forest magic. And the local belief, according to the text, is that the gods create these spells specifically for people who rebel against them. So this deep-seated fear means people think the only protection is pleasing the gods.
So defying the gods isn't just political, it's like inviting unseen magical trouble.
Exactly. And this ties into their beliefs about the afterlife in Dilmun, too. You need to stay on the gods' good side in this life for peace after death. So the journey isn't just physically hard. It's psychologically terrifying, filled with this fear of divine payback through these spells.
Amidst all this external danger and the fear of the gods, Mad is grappling with something really deep inside.
The source really highlights his conviction. He absolutely refuses to repeat what happened at Arj before, the Arj disaster or the massacre. His deepest desire is Bir Kurtariche Yashatan Onmalidi Uldurten de Il. He wants to be a savior, someone who gives life, not someone who causes death.
He feels fundamentally different from everyone around him.
He sees others as just, alishtiklere gibi yeshurlarde, living the way they're accustomed to, maybe even bulerde yesir olmak, enslaved by these spells, or at least the fear of them. But Mad has this intense need to live authentically. Doru yashame istyurdo, which means living by his own truth, even if it means he has to tanrlara bile itiras edi, stand up to the gods themselves.
And he feels this pressure to just fit in. That maybe people are trying to enslave him in a different way.
The text mentions his perception that the respect or value others show him might be a subtle attempt to kendilarin estir istirlarde, to capture him, make him one of them, make him accept their fears and limitations.
Which brings into this core question. It's quite powerful. If he gives in, if he just lives like everyone else and lets these evil spells dictate everything, who's going to fight them?
Mad daon largi yashamana ve duygularını kurtubiyulera teslime derse kurtubiyulera karşı kim savaşacaktı?
It frames his personal struggle as almost this cosmic battle against fear and control, doesn't it? A fight he feels he has to take on because nobody else seems willing or able to.
They finally make it to Arj, and it's not the quiet village they left behind.
No, the source shows it's changing fast. It's being fortified, stone walls going up, turning into a proper city fortress, twice as many huts as before. And the people greet them with this huge enthusiasm, like hunters coming back with a big kill.
And Ninshuber already has a plan in motion, a strategy.
The immediate goal is to stop a key Babylonian project.
Okay.
They're digging this canal near Supar, which is only 2 days from Babylon itself. She wants to send 20 warriors there to basically sabotage the work, buy time until the Sumerian cities are ready for a bigger war come spring.
And getting those warriors into enemy territory needs some careful maneuvering.
Right. They'll go via Dilbat, a Sumerian border city, then through Borsippa, and finally slip into Babylon or Sippar. The plan is for the warriors to split up, enter Babylon in disguise at different times so they don't attract attention, before heading to Borsippa.
Okay, so the infiltration starts. The first team goes in Mad, Pugat, led by Mashnu, pretending to be a merchant.
And this part gives us a little snapshot of Babylon through Mad's eyes. There's a scene where Mad wants to feed a beggar woman, but the innkeeper is reluctant, you know, worried about getting paid, worried she'll cause trouble later. Mad has to insist his father is rich and generous to get the innkeeper to agree. It just shows you the kind of transactional vibe, even for small acts of kindness.
As they head towards Borsippa, the source says something interesting. Despite the danger, they're actually cheerful.
Yeah, maybe it's that sense of shared purpose or just gallows humor before they have to split up. Even Mad is noted as laughing sometimes. But Pugat. Pugat is noticeably quiet, worried, during this last stretch together.
They travel through this barren, muddy land after the forests and end up camping in a cave near Borsippa because it's freezing.
And it's in that cave Mad and Pugat have this really crucial conversation. Pugat is deeply troubled by bad dreams. He specifically says this is the third time he's had this recurring nightmare.
Mad tries to comfort him, using Ram's earlier words.
He reminds Pugat what Ram said about spells or bad magic-like dreams only affecting believers. He tries to convince him it's just a nightmare, you know, not a real omen.
Mad also explains why they absolutely have to split up, following Ninshubur's plan.
He lays it out. She needs to go undercover among the slaves in Sippar. Pugat stays in the city. It's strategic. They need to be separate so one can potentially help the other, and it protects the other warriors involved by sticking to the plan, safety in the structure.
And Pugat just comes out and says it.
He says, Korkuyura Mad. I'm afraid Mad. Mad takes his hands, reassures him, but also kind of gently challenges him, saying he thought Pugat was stronger, that he wouldn't give in to bad magic. The source notes, they go back into the cave, but neither of them can sleep, just wrestling with their thoughts, their fears.
Masnu then lays out the precise orders for the infiltration teams.
It's a really bold plan. Mad and seven others, working in pairs, have to go to Sippar and deliberately commit crimes. Crimes serious enough to get them sentenced to hard labor in the canals. That's their way in, become prisoners.
While the others have different covers.
Right. Six others, in groups of three, will go into Babylon or Sippar pretending to be blacksmiths looking for work. And Mashnu, Pugat, and six more will pose as merchants, setting up the network for communication.
Communication being the absolute key.
The lifeline, totally. They need a way to pass messages between Sippar and Babylon without anyone catching on, reporting back to Masnu, who then gets word to Ninshubur in Arj once a month.
And Masnu is blunt about the risks.
It's Babylonian territory, extremely dangerous. He stresses that one slip-up could doom everyone, and he gives that really harsh but pragmatic order. Gerakirsa hepenitsi telekaya maktansa, birinitsi feda at mekten de hetin mayen. If it comes down to it, sacrifice one person rather than risk the whole group. Mad's team is the first to head out.
As Mad is preparing for this, or maybe while he's briefly in Babylon before heading to the ditch, the source gives us another peek into his thoughts, his observations about Babylon.
He's reflecting on all the wealth piled up in Babylon and the treasure houses, the ziggurats, and he sees it all controlled by priests and gods who use these Kutsal Kniflar, these sacred justifications to legitimize their power. He questions who puts the seal on all that silver, comparing it to branding slaves. It's a sharp insight into how power uses ideology, doesn't it?
And this connects right back to his own mission.
Exactly. He's wondering, how can he possibly achieve his goal, Bugerdevi Nazul Basharakakte, without causing a bloodbath, without people just slaughtering each other over these evil spells or the systems built on them.
He seems pretty doubtful about changing things from the inside.
He doubts Marduk or the Babylonians will listen to him. He wonders if Inanna's magic will even work here, what it really is, why the gods keep it hidden from him. He feels completely misunderstood.
It sounds like the only person he feels might get him is Ram.
The text suggests maybe only Ram understands him. Possibly because Ram also seems to avoid the gods' direct conflicts, perhaps fearing punishment after whatever happened before. Mad questions why he's putting himself back in the line of fire like this.
They also notice a practical difference between Babylon and Uruk.
Yeah, Babylon, for all its wealth, is described as having surprisingly few slaves compared to Uruk.
And he gets his first look at the famous Tower of Marduk. The ziggurat.
It's described as just immense, a structure where people actually live and work on every level, shops, houses, and the priests are tied to their temples, almost like parts of the building, unable to leave their posts. The source includes that detail about Mad staging losing silver with Sadar in a shop just to test the reaction. They find the shopkeeper and his men are ready for it, suggesting a system of control, or at least constant vigilance.
So Mad and Sadar follow the plan, commit a crime, get caught, and are sent to the canal ditch at Sippar.
They're marched along this muddy stream. The source really stresses how harsh the conditions are, how cruel the guards are, even worse than in Uruk, it says. The prisoners are terrified, silent. They know what's waiting for them.
Life in the canal ditch sounds absolutely horrific.
It is. They get minimal supplies, just linen covers, iron bowls. They're put into teams of 50, led by other prisoners chosen for their past crimes. These team leaders are brutal, enforcing order with whips, no swords, though. They hand out punishments seemingly at random.
And the whole system is corrupt.
Completely. Hako, one of the prisoners Mad meets, along with Nunkur, Anshar, Shamash, and Urshan, explains how deep it goes. Things like the covers and bowls given to them are systematically stolen and then sold back to the temple through the teen leaders and soldiers, a whole profit scheme built on their suffering.
And in this incredibly desperate place, Mad makes a really risky move.
He reveals who he really is to Hako, shows him the star necklace, the branding from Rom, claims he's Mad, the priest from Arj. Hako is skeptical at first, understandably, but the physical proof convinces him.
But this doesn't really seem to bring him closer to the others, does it?
No, the source says he feels shame, isolation after revealing himself. He starts sleeping separately from the main group. Sidar comes over to him one night while Mad's pretending to be asleep, hinting at how this revelation has maybe shifted their relationship too.
Daily life is just grindingly awful.
The food is described as berbata, terrible. But even in this despair, Mad finds that connection again through his music.
Playing the Buyuludil at night.
Yes. And it has this extraordinary effect. It captivates everyone in the ditch, apparently even the guards watching from above. The source uses this striking image. The music makes the ditch feel like an open grave, where their bodies are trapped, but their spirits can somehow feel free.
But again, only Mad really understands the full meaning.
He alone seems to grasp the depth of the lament, the yearning for freedom in the melodies. Hako is intrigued, asks where Mad learned to play this instrument he's never seen before.
Despite these small moments with music, the canal work is just powering ahead.
Yeah, new workers keep arriving, pushing the project forward really fast. And this is deeply discouraging for Mad. He hasn't managed to convince the others to resist, hasn't found a way to stop the digging.
He questions why the prisoners are so passive.
He wonders, "Bu insana reçeretave uzguluya neden bu kadar yabancı dinor?"
Why are these people so foreign to courage and freedom? He sees the priests' fear-mongering as their strongest magic, keeping the prisoners enslaved by their own terror. He feels like they have nothing left to lose but that fear.
And he sees a parallel to how he accepted things before.
He feels they're accepting their fate, just like he accepted his deal with Enki back in Abzu. But the difference is, he refuses to accept defeat now. Arj, Sumer, they're counting on him. He knows he has to find a way, somehow.
While Mad's grappling with this in the ditch, things are happening outside, too.
Masnu reports back to Ninshuber's contact. Confirms they've got security, permissions sorted in Babylon and Sippar, the plan's on track. But he makes a key request. Not just more slaves, but specifically skilled volunteer soldiers for Babylon. That suggests a shift, right? Towards a more direct kind of action.
Puga, meanwhile, is still consumed with worry about Mad.
The source really emphasizes his anxiety, especially after seeing Mad get captured. Pugat doesn't trust the others to look after Mad. He declares that if Mad gets back, he's not sending him away again. Whatever Mad decides, Pugat's sticking with him in Arj this time.
And there's that recurring detail about the pregnant horse.
Still sick, might foal early, still a worry. Mashnu tries to distract Pugat, offers him the foal to name if it's female. Pugat says he'll call her Tar. It's just this small human touch amidst all the high-stakes tension.
Back in the ditch, the guards' cruelty doesn't stop when the work does.
No. At night, the soldiers get bored, lose patience with the sleeping slaves. Sometimes they just kick them for amusement. The source says they see it as revenge for their own discomfort, or payment for their idle time. It's a brutal reminder of how dehumanized the prisoners are.
One of the other prisoners, Bartea, starts talking to Sidar.
Yeah, Barte tells Sidar he doesn't seem like a typical slave trader. And hints he could help them escape. He mentions he's heard rumors someone's coming to rescue them.
And Sidar is surprised he's being so open.
Yes, the text notes Bartea is shocked by Sidar's own openness in return. It's a risky conversation to have.
As tensions rise, Mad keeps trying to subtly build resistance.
He gets worried when Cassis, their contact, doesn't show up for a bit. Costas eventually returns during food distribution, says he convinced the supervisor to let him come more often, and promises he'll bring news from Masnu soon.
Mad's internal fight is still raging.
He keeps imagining confronting Marduk, the other gods, believing he has his own magic. He's still focused on returning to Inanna and Arj eventually.
And he directly challenges the other's fear again.
Uses that powerful metaphor, calling them Kuyunun Dibindeki Kurbazalar, frogs at the bottom of a well, compared to Gukta Özgür Usan Kuşlar, free birds in the sky. He plays the flute, trying to show his own inner freedom, offering them an alternative to just fear. But the music only brings temporary peace.
Hako is focused on revenge.
He vows he'll get Miku, the brutal team leader, after the canal is done, swears by Enlil the temple won't save him. But Mad counters, pointing out the bigger picture. Killing one Miku won't change the system. He'll just be replaced. It's about the structure of oppression.
Then the cruelty becomes immediate, visible, when Miku beats another prisoner.
Mad instinctively shouts, "Bubiukaksizlik!" This is a great injustice. Hako reacts violently, grabs Mad, threatens him if he talks about rights or freedom, again terrified of the consequences. But then he backs down. Shamash and Urshan comfort Mad. It shows you the complex mix of fear and simmering anger in the group.
Let's step out of the ditch for a second. What's happening back in Arj from Ninshuber's viewpoint?
Ninshuber is getting seriously concerned. The walls around Arj aren't going to be finished by spring. If Mad's mission fails, Arj is incredibly vulnerable, not just to Enki's people, but also to Marduk, who's threatening Sumer and Arj's vital iron mines. Arj feels caught, Ikiete Sarasunda, between two fires.
But Masnu's idea offers some hope.
She fully approves his plan to infiltrate actual soldiers, not just slaves, into Babylon and Sippar. She calls it Masnu Buyuk Ishler Basharmish. Masnu has achieved great things. She orders men from Uruk and Eridu to come to Arj immediately for training, preparing them to go undercover as either slaves or soldiers.
And that rumor, Barteya heard about a rescuer coming.
Sidar confirms it to him, tells Barteya he's not a slave trader, but yes, he can help them escape, reinforcing the idea that rescue is on the way. Barteya seems surprised, maybe even uncomfortable, now that it feels more real.
Back in the ditch, things escalate. It feels like we're heading towards a breaking point.
An old man collapses, can't breathe. Mad helps him, reflecting on the fate of those who die with no real place on Earth, hoping Inanna will somehow take this man, especially since he helped get her powers back. He wonders if she even hears his plea.
And then the weather itself steps in.
A huge storm hits, rain pouring down. The prisoners are terrified, praying to Ishkor, the storm god, son of An, for it to stop. But Mad reacts completely differently. He's not afraid.
He sees it as an opportunity.
Exactly. He sees the rain as a way to stop the work. He actually hopes the misery, the discomfort, will finally force the prisoners to confront their reality and push them to act. He even wishes it would rain until spring, seeing it as a kind of victory, even if he dies there.
But the others are just consumed by fear and despair.
Shamus suggests praying to the Sumerian gods, or even making a desperate break for Arj, says he'd rather die trying to escape than die trapped in the ditch.
Mad uses this moment, this desperation, to try and rally them one more time.
He pushes them to choose their fate. Keeps serving Marduk's magic by building his tower, his ditches, or join him in seeking freedom in Arj. He points out directly that Babylon's comfort, its great tower, it's all built on their backs, on slave labor like theirs.
While this storm is raging in the ditch, back in Arj, there's some serious political stuff happening.
Yeah, Priest Abu is getting really anxious. His dream interpretations aren't holding much weight with King Kerr anymore, especially after that weird goddess Pugat thing he mentions. He's worried he's going to be replaced, seeing King Kerr meeting with the second priest.
And the arrival of hundreds of soldiers makes him even more nervous.
He sees them as a bad omen, potentially, despite Gami's earlier promise from Enki that Mato wouldn't be harmed.
And then these seven envoys show up,
yeah,
lavishly dressed, claiming they're from Enki.
Their number, their appearance, it's all unexpected for King Kerr and Abu, and their message seems to clash with what Gami said before, adding to the confusion.
So King Kerr and Abu try to figure out what it all means.
Abu spins it as an opportunity. He thinks Enki offering friendship could be good for Mata's future, especially if they beat Babylon. He reinterprets Inanna's return as maybe triggering this divine attention, validating his first dream, the one he thought was bad before.
He's relieved the king buys it.
Oh yeah, he feels like he could fly, the source says. King Kerr agrees with this positive spin, decides they need to make a sacrifice to Enshag. And then the king declares he'll personally lead his army into Babylon, fighting alongside the Sumerian gods. He sees it as divinely ordained now.
Okay, back to the ditch. Life goes on after the storm, but maybe with a different energy.
Hammer distracts Hako so Mad can talk privately with his core group. Hammer shares some news from outside.
Kasus also comes back during mealtime, confirming he can visit more often now and will bring news from Masnu. Hako notices Hammer looks really sick and worn out from the conditions and feels bad for having pushed him so hard before. And Mad decides it's finally time. Time to share the escape plan.
He tells them the plan. They'll escape when Marduk's forces finally give up on the canal. And then he drops the big reveal.
Shuanda butsukuda pekchok argili savashi gizlen misturumda.
There are many Argili warriors hidden among the prisoners right now, with more coming, He stresses absolute secrecy is crucial.
Miku, the team leader, senses this shift in the prisoners' mood and reports it.
He tells the soldier he's worried about their growing defiance, correctly blaming the savior rumor that seems to be emboldening them and disrupting work. He insists the savior problem needs to be dealt with.
And the next morning, it's clear Miku's warning was heard.
The military presence around the ditch is significantly increased. A direct response.
This leads to a debate within Mad's group.
Ninkur is scared, wants to wait because of the extra soldiers, but Mad argues they have to act now. Courage is their only weapon against this kind of fear.
Ninkur wishes the savior was a warrior, someone who could just fight the soldiers.
And Mad gives his core belief again. He says, Kostolushimus kanero ordu, pukazde doktorimus kanen esiri koresio lorduk. Our salvation would be bloody. And then we'd just become slaves to the blood we spilled. His vision is still about avoiding that cycle of violence.
Faced with more soldiers, the fear takes over for many prisoners.
They start working harder, trying to avoid trouble. The team leaders are happy, thinking things are back under control. But Mad insists they must make a move, boost morale after Hako probably got beaten up by Miku the day before, and demoralize the authorities who seem to be regaining the upper hand.
It really feels like we're building to that turning point now. Defiance, sacrifice.
Midday break comes. Despite the threats, the whips, the prisoners are still working slowly. It's frustrating Miku and the soldiers. The source even says they regret Miku beating Hako yesterday, maybe realizing it didn't crush their spirit, just fueled this quiet resistance, still tied to the savior ideal.
Sinar makes a really sharp point about their struggle.
He says the cost of their miserable food implies freedom has a cost too. You have to earn it, pay for it somehow.
And the conditions are taking a terrible toll.
Yeah, the death rate is climbing cold, conditions, beatings. It's actually slowing the work down even more, ironically. The authorities are struggling. Trying to speed things up by punishing slow workers just causes more deaths, more delays. They're sabotaging themselves. The canal soldier had to ask the Babylon Temple for help.
But some prisoners are losing hope, clinging to the old system.
They start working harder, dreaming of rewards from the temple, desperate to get out of the ditch by finishing the job. They're even neglecting burying the dead properly. The canal might actually finish before spring, which is devastating news for Mad and his friends.
But the numbers are still shifting.
Despite the deaths, new prisoners keep arriving. Mm-hmm. The population doubles. The number of soldiers nearly triples. The source notes this is actually good for Mad's plan, more potential recruits, but bad for the work pace, which is still moving forward. The savior's influence seems to be fading against the immediate misery. Mad feels this huge pressure to prove Arge, to prove freedom is real.
Ninkur says something small that Mad picks up on.
She just observes, Yazga deishi yormush fate changes. And Mad immediately connects it to their situation, saying, if they succeed in defying the authorities, they will change the prisoner's fate.
Meanwhile, outside the ditch, Mashnu and Pugyat are doing something unusual for Kasis.
They're acquiring a large amount of sinameki, described as a magic herb. Mashu's buying it carefully, small batches from different places, getting it ready for Kasis.
And this magic herb has a very practical effect.
Widespread diarrhea. Hits both the prisoners and the soldiers who eat the same food. It completely stops work for a day or two. Mad sees this delay differently than just a break. It's a strategic disruption.
The prisoners are also really struggling with the lack of rest.
They're on rotation, only sleeping every other day. They complain constantly. Ninkur and Hamar, being older, are finding it especially hard. Again, Mad seems to view this suffering differently, maybe as the pressure needed to force a change.
Their exhaustion leads them to collectively ask for something.
They beg the authorities for just one full day of rest, argue they'll work better afterwards. The authorities actually debate it, but grant the request. They see it as the lesser evil compared to pushing them harder and causing more deaths and delays. And the source notes, they blame the courage to even ask on the Argeli youth, hinting Mad's influence is recognized.
So now Mad faces this incredibly tense dilemma going into the next day.
He feels the weight of responsibility for what might happen because of their defiance. He knows the Argeli warriors are there, hidden, part of the network, but they can't openly fight yet.
He sees no way to just talk the soldiers down.
No, he's agonizing. How can they resist tomorrow without getting hurt or killed? What if the prisoners just give in to fear and decide to work? How can he stop them? He feels like tomorrow, is it? The end of the line, one way or another? He plans to talk to his friends Mkasis at breakfast.
While Mad's going through this, Ugat, back in Babylon, has that terrifying nightmare again.
It's the third time, but this time it's horrifyingly clear. He sees a body falling from the sky, and he recognizes the face. It's Mad. He wakes up screaming, crying, utterly convinced Mad is dead or terribly hurt.
And the subplot with the pregnant horse continues amidst this rising tension.
Pugat reports the horse is definitely sick, probably going to foal early, which is still a problem. Masnu tries again to lighten the mood, offering Pugat the foal to name Tar if it's female. Just this small, persistent worry alongside the huge life-or-death one.
The next morning, the crisis finally breaks in the ditch.
At breakfast, Kasis finds Mad and the group. He's excited, brings the crucial news from Masnu. The four-day escape plan is a go. Urshan, maybe just overcome with relief, blurts it out to everyone there.
Hemmer expresses his relief, saying he couldn't have held on much longer.
And the source notes Surma is watching them discreetly during this crucial exchange.
Meanwhile, back in Babylon, Commander Shamud is dealing with his own issues.
He's trying to prepare the city's defenses against the Sumerians, but needs reliable men for a dangerous mission probably related to the canals. Not many volunteer. Gutan steps up, looking for glory, and Shamud sends him off.
Back at the canal ditch, the authorities make their move against Mad, the perceived source of the defiance.
He's dragged out and whipped at the stake above the ditch. He endures it silently, holding his breath, thinking of Siddhar's resilience, determined to keep up the savior image, to inspire them through his suffering.
Some prisoners watch, others just hear it. Mad's team watches from below.
The violence escalates instantly. Shamash, unable to stand it, runs towards Mad, but is shot down by arrows from the guards. Hako, sensing something awful is happening, rushes up too, ignoring his friends trying to stop him. Miku intercepts Hako, whips him, but Hako tackles Miku, headbutts him, draws blood, a desperate act of defiance.
Chaos just erupts.
Soldiers grab Hako immediately. Miku, furious and bleeding, kicks the helpless Hako repeatedly while he's down. Then the soldiers just roughly roll the stunned Hako back into the ditch. Ninkur and Hammer rush to help him. Urshan cries out. In a moment of raw despair, Ninkur actually kicks Urshan. Anshar has to pull them apart. The ditch is just pure chaos, violence, despair.
After this horrific scene, Commander Shamud arrives.
He talks to the soldiers. Then two soldiers take the unconscious Mad down from the stake and carry him into a tent. The prisoners see this, and many feel a tiny flicker of hope. Maybe Mad survived. Maybe Shamud is keeping some promise. But Shamud has other priorities.
He rushes to the priest's tent. The priest is already packing. Shamud says they're ready to leave for Babylon with half the army. The priest just smiles like this is all part of his plan.
So Shamud and the priest leave with half the troops, while Gutan stays behind.
And it's here Gutan learns more from Kasis about Mad's efforts, about Sidar's death. Gutan saw Mad being punished, regrets he couldn't help. He tells Sidar, the one who survived, clarifying this for us, that Mad's in a guarded tent, but Henuz Hershiebit Mish Digil. Not everything is over.
And Sidar takes this as a sign Gutan is planning to rescue Mad.
Back in the ditch, the survivors of Mad's group, Ninkur, Anshar, Urshan, Hamar, Hako, they're just trying to process the trauma. For Urshan keeps insisting the men who rolled Hako down were Onlar, the enemies, the ones on their side. Hako is still reeling, struggling to accept Shamas and Sidar are dead.
They feel completely crushed. Nothing went according to plan. Death came before any real fight or escape. They start questioning the whole point, the war, the fight for freedom now that their friends are gone. They wonder if they can ever leave the memory of the dead behind or if they'll just carry the ditch, the tragedy, with them forever.
While they're lost in this despair, Mad wakes up somewhere else entirely.
He's in an old man's hut. The source hints it might be Ram who saved him, or maybe just someone in the network. He finds out two children pulled him from the river. He's totally confused, doesn't remember getting there, doesn't remember putting on clothes, just remembers the whipping, being stripped, passing out, holding his breath. He realizes it wasn't a dream. And his very first question, totally focused, is, Tanri Mardukun Kanalara Neredi. Where are Marduk's canals? Still on mission.
And just as Mad is recovering, the battle they were waiting for finally explodes at the canal site.
It's sudden, totally chaotic. Panic erupts among the prisoners. People get trampled. The source specifically says Hammer is crushed, knocked unconscious in the stampede. Hako and Urshan fight through the chaos, trying to get to Hammer.
Hako manages to scramble out of the ditch while the fighting rages.
And he sees it. Babylonian soldiers fighting Argeli warriors. The hidden fighters are revealed. He spots Gutan actually stopping a soldier from getting to the prisoners, proving Urshan was right about them being allies. He sees Kasis and others taking off their helmets, identifying themselves as Argeli warriors joining the fray. And he sees slaves, Maybe the ones Mad influenced, maybe those hidden slave warriors actually helping the Argelli fighters.
Seeing this confirms everything Mad had told them.
It does. Hako witnesses the courage of the hidden Argelli, the unexpected help from slaves, and in that moment realizes his own resolve is stronger than he knew when he was trapped in despair. He wonders if those fighting with the Argelli were really slaves or the hidden warriors Mad mentioned.
So after this incredibly intense, chaotic battle, what's the outcome?
Commander Shamood, remember him, he gets back to Babylon after winning what he thought was the main fight at a diversion camp, only to realize he was totally tricked. Enki's empty tents were just a ruse. The main Sumerian army went straight for the canals. He has to report back to the priest in Babylon. They were fooled. They need to prepare to defend the city itself.
But at the canal, the Sumerians won.
Yes, a swift victory for the Sumerian army. They fought with discipline, gained the upper hand at a key moment. The remaining Babylonians retreated. The Sumerian army achieved its objective. Now they need to secure prisoners, pursue fugitives.
And we get this really poignant conversation after the battle, linking back to the ditch.
Hako is talking to a wounded man, could be an Argelli warrior, maybe one of the slaves who fought. Both admit it was their first time ever using a sword, and they did it for Arj. Hako confesses how angry he was in the ditch, feeling like the savior hadn't shown up when they needed him. He tells the wounded man Mad would be proud of him.
And Ninker is there, listening to this.
She makes this incredibly self-aware admission. Says she and the others who spend months with Mad just fail to truly understand him. They chose to hide their heads in the ditch, too afraid to really embrace the freedom he was offering.
The Sumerian leaders then have to decide what's next.
Isimut, Tammuz, and Kotar are discussing it. Tammuz wants to march straight on Babylon. But Isimut says, no, their agreement with Enki was only to stop the canals. He declares he's taking Enki's share of the captured 2,000 soldiers, 7,000 slaves, back to Eridu.
Kotar asks, what about Babylon then?
Isimut points out the obvious. They can't attack Babylon while trying to manage this huge number of prisoners. The agreed-upon goal is done. Move on.
The source wraps up this section with a really powerful statement from a captive slave. It shows the impact of everything that happened.
Yeah, a captured slave is asked who he fought for. He doesn't get the political nuances, but he knows about the Argelli savior who, in his eyes, sacrificed himself. After seeing the battle, the courage, the win, he feels fighting for that savior's cause was the only thing worthwhile.
And he feels like something fundamental has shifted inside him.
He says the ruler's magic is broken. He concludes fear was the source of all the evil, the enslavement, while freedom, represented by Arj, by the savior, was the source of good. He's not afraid anymore. He stands tall and answers loudly. Argelli kurtarece isin savaştım. I fought for the Argelli savior. It shows how the idea of the savior took on a life of its own.
So the Argelli savior becomes this legend, born in the ditch, forged in battle. But what actually happened to Mad himself?
The narrative shifts again. This time it seems Ram is narrating. A young man asks Ram where Mad was during all this and why he didn't come back to Arj after escaping the ditch.
And Ram gives us the final, really unexpected twist.
Ram explains Mad did return to Arj the day before Gutan brought his men back. But he watched it from a distance. He saw it was completely walled in now. So enclosed, he couldn't even see the temple inside anymore.
He realized it wasn't the place he'd fought for. Not the place he remembered.
Ardenin Artik. O Hadrladu. Arji ol Maduna, Farketi. He realized Arj's was no longer the Arj he remembered. He decided it just wasn't the place he wanted to live anymore.
And so, after everything, he just turned around and left.
The source says Mad left without anyone seeing him, deciding where he needed to go, Nere Getmesi Gerekti Gine Yolda Karar Verdi, while he was already on his way somewhere else. His destination wasn't Arj, it was decided on the road away from it.
Ram adds one last piece of context, placing the story historically.
Right, just briefly mentions the rise of Hammurabi later on, how he established power, made alliances, and then eventually turned on his former allies, Mari and Larsa. These cities had sided with Babylon against Sumer, and now they had to submit to Marduk and Hammurabi, paying the price for that earlier defiance. It puts Mad's personal struggle into that larger historical flow.
Wow, what a journey. We followed Mad from that isolated longing in a false paradise, through this perilous world of gods and magic, right into the absolute horror of that canal ditch, We saw his internal battle against just fitting in, against fear. We saw those quiet acts of defiance, the sudden bursts of chaotic violence, the sacrifice, and the sheer power of an idea, the savior-inspiring action.
And we pulled out insights, didn't we, about power structures, about different kinds of resistance, passive and active, the complex role of belief, fear, and the courage it takes to even want freedom against such odds. And Mad's consistent vision, wanting to be a savior who creates life, not death, constantly clashing with the brutal reality he faced.
But the thing that really sticks with you, that final twist in the source material, is Mad's decision. After all that struggle, all the longing, fighting for Arch, he doesn't go back. He sees it, realizes it's change, and just turns away, finds a new path.
It leaves you with a really powerful question to mull over, doesn't it? What does it actually mean to fight, to sacrifice, to yearn for a place, a home, a vision of freedom, only to get there and find the destination itself has become something you don't recognize anymore? Or maybe... maybe the journey, the fight, has changed you so much that the place you long for just isn't where you belong anymore. Where do you go when home isn't there? Something for you to think about from the material you shared.
Indeed. A really compelling end to this deep dive. We hope this exploration of your source material has given you some fresh perspectives and insights into this incredible narrative.